Chapter 6, When Truth Reveals Itself, The Cost of Silence, The Cost of Lies. Truth. I ask you right now to pause and think about what that word means to you. Most of us can give a definition without much effort. The harder question is not what truth is, but how we apply it. Especially when it becomes uncomfortable, inconvenient, or costly. When I retired from full-time law enforcement in 2013, I had already felt a shift taking place, not just in policing, but in society itself. The shared understanding of basic truths, things once assumed and rarely debated, had begun to fracture. Words that once carried common meaning no longer did. The rules were changing, often quietly, sometimes aggressively, and rarely with consensus. I was relieved to be stepping away, not because I didn't care, but because I had already given decades of my life to navigating gray areas in a job that demanded clarity. I worried about my children and grandchildren, and of course, I also understood something fundamental. Every generation faces its own trial. Mine was no exception. In law enforcement, truth is not philosophical. It's operational. It determines who is protected, who is restrained, and who is believed. And when truth is ignored or intentionally distorted, the consequences are real, immediate, and sometimes irreversible. I once became involved with a young offender who was already deep within the system. He'd been removed from his school and placed into a private, semi-secure educational setting due to serious and escalating behavior. By the time I encountered him, the warning signs were not subtle, nor were they new. I was called to the home of his mother and stepfather to speak with their young daughter, approximately 6 or 7 years old, regarding allegations of sexual abuse that occurred while the boy was still living at home. What follows is not speculation, nor hindsight. It is the account given to me directly by the family and corroborated by institutional records. The boy had been removed from the middle school after repeatedly attempting to access the girls' physical education locker room. He had expressed violent sexual fantasies involving young girls through writings and drawings. These disclosures were taken seriously, at least on paper. Yet the question no one seemed prepared to answer was the most important one to me. How do you manage a person like this when they remain embedded in a family and a community? The family was terrified. So much so that the parents and her young daughter locked themselves in the master bedroom at night to feel safe. They had reason to believe their daughter had already been abused. They also disclosed that the boy had exhibited sexually abusive behavior toward the family dog. That was my baseline when they asked me for advice on how to protect themselves. What troubled me most was not just what was happening inside of the home, but what was happening outside of it. Despite everything, this boy still had access to the public. The system had isolated the risk on paper, but not in reality. When I spoke to the child, whose name is intentionally left out, she was young, innocent, and resilient. Whatever had been done to her had not yet destroyed her spirit. That resilience, in my experience, almost always reflects the presence of adults who take a child seriously and act to protect them. Victims who are ignored or dismissed often carry those wounds for life. Eventually, the offender was placed in a secure facility and later transferred to a specialized school designed to manage children with this exact type of behavior. The financial cost to the school district was enormous. The human cost of ignoring the warning signs would have been far worse. What stayed with me then and now was how many well-intentioned people continued to make excuses for this boy in the name of compassion. I spent enough time around predators to know that while behavior may be controlled, the underlying urges do not simply disappear. I would not be surprised to hear this young man's name again someday. He is still here in the Capital District. That is the cost of silence. That is the cost of misplaced mercy. Why details matter? Every victim I've ever worked with was asked a simple question early in the process. Do you know the difference between a truth and a lie? We teach that distinction from a very young age, yet we rarely talk about when lies are permitted, excused, or even encouraged. Research suggests that most people tell 1 to 2 meaningful lies per day, while reporting few or none. The difference between truth and deception often lives in the details, the kind that cannot be rehearsed or fabricated. I once investigated a case involving a 15-year-old girl who reported being sexually assaulted by her stepfather. At first, even I struggled to believe her. Other people were present in the home at the time. She did not present in the way that people expect a victim to present. Even her own mother was conflicted, wanting to believe her, but clearly uncertain. During the interview, one detail seemed almost incidental. She described how prior to the assault, he placed a towel on the bed so as not to make a mess. When the mother later read that statement, she dropped the paper on the table and began to cry. She looked at me and said, "She's telling the truth." The towel detail was something the girl could not have known unless it happened to her. The mother then disclosed that the same act had previously been demanded of her, described in the same manner. The case eventually resulted in an arrest. Years later, the conviction was overturned on a technicality. I still don't know why. What I do know is this: the truth revealed itself through a detail no liar would think to invent. In the legal system, truth is formalized. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? I raised my right hand and answered, "I do," more times than I can count. We swear to it in court, on affidavits, in front of judges whose signatures carry real consequences. Presenting false information does not just undermine a case, it compromises the integrity of the entire system. Early in my career, I learned that if a case was not prosecutable, a judge would not sign off on it. No amount of creative writing could change that. There were plenty of temptations to stretch the facts for what someone believed was the right outcome. I never took that road. The truth is easier to remember, and it doesn't require charts to keep it straight. I was comfortable on the witness stand because I never had to guess which version of events I was supposed to recall. Ironically, later in my career, I found myself sitting on that very stand as a defendant. And in that moment, I learned something I already knew, but had never felt so personally. Truth is dangerous when the people opposing you do not respect it. Facing serious charges that could have altered my life permanently, I kept my mouth shut. Not because I was wrong, but because the system made honesty too expensive. Silence in that moment was survival. Reputation. Reputation is what remains when everything else is stripped away. It cannot be bought. It cannot be inherited. It is earned over time through consistency. I've never been a liar, and at times that has cost me. But every morning I can look in the mirror and respect the person looking back at me. That matters more than approval, promotion, or comfort. People who lie well may advance quickly, but they rarely last. The paper trail always catches up. History does not change, and when a lie is committed to paper and signed, it becomes something else entirely. Perjury. I learned early how to protect myself within the rules. I also learned that when someone has to build their career on distortion and maneuvering, they will always see truth as a threat. That is why silence has a cost. That is why lies do as well. Truth may be inconvenient. It may be dangerous. It may demand sacrifice. But it is the only thing that does not change. And in the end, it is the only thing that stands.